You're listening to This Week in Fantasy Baseball. Hello, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Fantasy Baseball. I'm your host, John Kuh. Unfortunately, Lee could not be here today, so it's just a solo pod for me, but we've got a lot to talk about. In this episode, we'll recap the hitter and pitcher performances from this week, talk about the latest news around baseball, give you all some streamer recommendations for next week, and then pitcher list writer Randy Holt will join the show to talk about the Milwaukee Brewers. Before we get into it, just a reminder that you can follow our podcast on Twitter at ThisWeekPL, and you can send us your fantasy baseball questions to our email at thisweekplpod@gmail.com. Lastly, make sure that you subscribe to or follow the podcast on whatever streaming platform that you listen to your podcast. We're on all of them, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, so make sure that you follow us and leave a 5-star review if you enjoy listening to the show. Now, right into the news. We're going to start with Blake Snell of the Padres, who was placed on the 15-day IL on Wednesday with a grade 2 adductor strain. Manager Bob Melvin said that Snell could spend more than the minimum 15 days on the injured list due to this injury. Snell was struggling to start the year, and you have to think that maybe he wasn't performing well and got injured because he was signed late and built up quickly. Obviously a tough blow for the Giants and fantasy managers alike. Brayan Bello of the Red Sox was placed on the 15-day IL on Wednesday as well, with right lat tightness. He felt discomfort following his most recent start on Friday, but the team is optimistic that he'll be able to return after the minimum 15 days. Tristan Casas of the Red Sox was placed on the 10-day IL on Sunday, April 21st, with a fractured rib. Manager Alex Cora said that Casas will be out for a while after an MRI revealed that fracture. There are a lot of Red Sox players that are injured. Lucas Giolito, Chris Murphy, Trevor Story, Liam Hendricks, Isaiah Campbell, Garrett Whitlock, Nick Pivetta, Vaughn Grissom, Romy Gonzalez, Tyler Heineman, and then now Brayan Bello and Tristan Casas. So, yeah, it's really tough for Boston. A lot of those guys are also out for season, so really unfortunate luck for them. Cody Bellinger of the Cubs was placed on the 10-day IL with right rib fractures. Bellinger collided with the center field wall in last Monday's games. Initially, x-rays were negative, but a CT scan revealed a fracture in his right rib, so he'll be out for the time being. Lane Thomas of the Nationals was placed on the 10-day IL with a grade 2 MCL strain. He's currently without a timetable for a return, but you never love to see those MCL injuries. Francisco Alvarez of the Mets was placed on the 10-day IL with a torn UCL in his left thumb. He underwent surgery and is expected to miss 8 weeks of action. That means he should return sometime in late June. JD Martinez is expected to join the Mets on Friday, so we'll see if that offseason addition does any help for the Mets and their offense. Christian Javier of the Astros was placed on the 15-day IL with a neck injury. Gavin Williams of the Guardians was shut down after suffering a setback with his right elbow. Again, he's been out for a while because of the injury. He felt some discomfort in his most recent simulated game, so he'll receive an injection and be shut down for 7 days. Merrill Kelly was placed on the 15-day IL with a teres major strain of his right shoulder. He's going to likely miss 1 month. Frankie Montas of the Reds was placed on the 15-day IL on Monday with a right forearm contusion. He was hit in the forearm by a comebacker during his start on Sunday, but fortunately for him, no structural damage due to that situation. His teammate Jake Fraley has been missing games due to illness, and as of Friday, he is still not in the starting lineup. Zach Gelof of the Athletics was placed on the 10-day IL on Thursday with a left oblique strain. Usual timetable for this is about 4 to 6 weeks, so unfortunate for Gelof to be dealing with that. Pete Fairbanks of the Rays was placed on the 15-day IL on Monday with a nerve-related condition. Fairbanks has previously dealt with Raynaud's syndrome, although it's unclear if he's dealing with the same symptoms now. Nolan Jones of the Rockies was removed from Tuesday's game with back stiffness. He was held out of Wednesday's and Thursday's game as well, so we'll see if he will be in the lineup anytime soon. As of Friday, he is currently not in the starting lineup. Tyro Estrada left Wednesday's game against the Mets due to tightness in his left hamstring, and as of Friday, he is not in the starting lineup. Cal Raleigh of the Mariners missed Wednesday's game due to dental issue. He had to undergo an emergency procedure to remove a broken tooth. Don't love that, but as of Friday, he is in the starting lineup. J.P. Crawford of the Mariners was stretched from Wednesday's lineup due to right oblique soreness. He is not in Wednesday's lineup. Louis Varland of the Twins was optioned to AAA St. Paul on Monday. In his place, Simeon Woods Richardson was called up, and we'll talk about his start a little bit later. Jordan Walker of the Cardinals was optioned to AAA Memphis on Wednesday. Addison Barger was called up by the Blue Jays on Wednesday, went 0-4 in his debut. Heston Kjerstad was called up by the Orioles on Tuesday, went 0-4 in his debut, and then sat the next day against the lefty. And then Jackson Holliday, the former number one overall pick, was sent back down to AAA to kind of figure things out as he had been struggling this season. That's all the news and notes. Obviously, a lot of injuries to keep track of. Definitely check out the MLB Morning News articles on PitcherList to get a full list of all the important injuries that might affect your fantasy team. Moving on to player performances, we are going to start on the weekend, April 19th, with the hitter recap articles. Thanks to Brian Amore, Kevin O'Brien, and Kyle Stanzel for their contributions. We're going to start with Travis d'Arnaud of Atlanta, 3-for-4 with 3 homers, 3 runs, and 6 RBI. With Sean Murphy being out since basically the first game of the season, d'Arnaud has been the main catcher for Atlanta with 66 plate appearances. He's had a respectable stat line with 11 runs, 15 RBI, and he's been slashing .293, .364, .655. After this 3-home run game, d'Arnaud had a couple more games with solo homers, and Murphy still looks to be out for several more weeks because he's dealing with his oblique injury, so d'Arnaud will probably provide some additional firepower to your lineup if you're looking for help at catcher for the time being. Patrick Bailey of the Giants went 4-for-4 with 2 doubles, a homer, a run, and 3 RBIs on Saturday, which was honestly a day for the catchers, as along with d'Arnaud, there were multiple other catchers with homers. Bailey has struggled this season with strikeouts. He's seen some improvement bringing that rate down to 24%, and his walk rate is back up to where it was in the minors, which is a good thing. The 300 average is especially nice, but unfortunately that's kind of where Bailey's usefulness in fantasy ends, as the counting stats really just aren't there. He's had relatively consistent playing time, but just isn't doing much with that time beyond getting hits. Alex Verdugo of the Yankees went 3-for-4 with a run, 2 RBIs, and a walk. Verdugo has been slowly acclimating to being part of this Yankees lineup, and he's batting 7th currently. He's getting a decent amount of runs, but being in the lower half of the lineup has led to less RBI opportunities. He's not necessarily hitting for the same average we've been more accustomed to seeing from him when he was in Boston, but the OBP is up this season as he's brought down the strikeout rate and he has increased his walk rate to career bests. He still doesn't have much value in fantasy, unfortunately. He's probably an outfielder 4 or 5 at best, but if he could somehow change his all-fields approach to pull the ball more, he may be able to take more advantage of that short porch in the Bronx, but honestly wouldn't expect too much from that. Moving on to pitchers, we're going to start with Spencer Turnbull of the Phillies, who went up against the White Sox on Friday, got a win there. He went 7 innings with no earned runs, 1 hit, 2 walks, and 6 strikeouts. Turnbull has been lights out this season with a 1.33 ERA and a 0.85 whip. Other than a 4-inning blip against the Pirates, he's provided value for your fantasy team every single start. And this one against one of the worst teams in the league, Turnbull cooked the White Sox, getting whiffs with a sweeper and loads of called strikes with a 4-seamer. The only question is whether he can stay up as part of the rotation. The hot stove seems to indicate that he'll be sent to the bullpen to allow Taijuan Walker to debut for the Phillies, and that is honestly just a shame. Luis Castillo of Seattle went up against Colorado, got the win there in Denver. 7 innings with 0 earned runs, 2 hits, 1 walk, and 9 strikeouts. We talked with Ryan Lauren 2 episodes ago about Luis Castillo, and he's finally righted the ship in Colorado of all places, where his 4-seamer earned 19 combined called strikes and whiffs. The slider also added 7 whiffs on its own. He got another quality start against Texas on Thursday, making it 3 straight quality starts where he's averaged a strikeout per inning. Castillo is back, guys. And then finally on Sunday, Mitchell Parker of the Nationals went up against the Astros, 7 innings with no earned runs, 3 hits, no walks, and 8 strikeouts. We recommended Parker as a streamer last week, assuming he survived this Astros start. But wow, he didn't just survive, he thrived. That 4-seamer curveball mix from him was earning called strikes, and he used his splitter to get 7 whiffs as well, good for a 47% swinging strike rate on that pitch alone. He has 3 legitimate pitches and knows how to use them, and I definitely think he is a good start for this upcoming weekend. On Monday, thanks to Mark Stubinger for the Anything You Canna Do, Mark Can Do Better hitter recap article. We are going to start, of course, with Mark Canna of the Tigers. Even though we talked about him last week, he's been doing really well for himself. 3-for-4 with a homer, 2 runs, and 2 RBIs on Monday. He has a 260, 400, 532 slash line, 5 homers, 12 runs, 12 RBI, and 1 stolen base to boot. The plate discipline looks excellent, and he's hitting the ball harder this year as well. He's not someone I'd necessarily prioritize in shallower leagues like 10 and 12 teamers with only 3 outfielder spots, but if your league has 5 outfielder spots, no matter the size, Canna should be rostered and started because he started this season out hot. And that Tigers offense, even though it is sort of like a bottom of the league offense, there's been really good contributors. We're going to talk about another one in a little bit. But yeah, Marcana has been a really good bright spot for that team in general. Reese Hoskins of the Brewers went 1-for-3 with a homer, a run, 2 RBIs, and a walk. He hit a solo shot off Jared Jones, pulling a 96 mile per hour heater from that incredible fastball from Jones over the left center field wall. Reese is now up to 5 homers this season, and Mark pointed out in this article that his 345 WOBA as of that Monday is identical to his 2022 mark. That season, Hoskins hit 30 home runs. So if we can get that kind of production out of Hoskins this season, that is going to be phenomenal. Moving on to pitchers, thanks to Nick Pollock for the Treasure in the Paddock SP Roundup article. We're going to start with Jared Jones, who we just can't stop talking about. 6 innings, 1 earned run, 4 hits, 2 walks, and 7 strikeouts. The incredible thing here was the golden goal, 25 whips, 43% CSW. He's been unbelievable and actually just broke an MLB record. Shout out to Sarah Langs on Twitter for this stat. Jones has 98 swings and misses this season, which is the most by a pitcher in his first 5 career starts in the pitch tracking era, which starts in 2008. The prior record was Masahiro Tanaka with 84. The crazy thing? Jones also set the record for most swings and misses through their first career 6 starts without making his 6th start, because Tanaka also held that record with 96. He's the new Spencer Strider, and he is dope. We're also going to talk about Ranger Suarez. Again, we just keep talking about him because he's on a straight-up just a Fargus roll. 7 innings with no one runs, 2 hits, 1 walk, and 5 strikeouts. Ranger just keeps on rolling. Nick still has him awfully low on his list and is labeling him as a Vargas rule, but Lee personally thinks that he's better than what he's being labeled as. We've seen Suarez be this good before, mainly in relief, and he's beginning transitioning into being a starter. That was a pretty good experiment. The pitch separation and pitch mix looks like something that can yield full season results this year, though. So Lee is clearly a believer. I say just keep starting him. There's no reason to take him out of your lineup for sure. And then finally, Chris Paddock, 7 innings with no runs, 6 hits, no walks, 10 strikeouts. I had to talk about my boy. Of course, he got this against the White Sox, but I will take that from Chris Paddock. Moving on to Tuesday's hitter recap, thanks to Christian Onneman for Talk That Talk. We're starting with Riley Green of the Detroit Tigers, 2-for-3 with 2 homers, 2 runs, 3 RBIs, and a walk. Green is currently top 10 in runs right now and has a crazy 20% walk rate with an OPS of 881. His PLV hitter performance also concurs, putting him in the above 90th percentile for runs added, which is greater than 2 runs, I believe. If this can be consistent for the rest of the season, we may get to see a legitimate breakout for Green, along with some really good starts, again, from Mark Canna, as we mentioned, but also Spencer Torkelson, Carey Carpenter. That team is doing pretty decent. Elly De La Cruz is next, 1-for-3 with a homer, 2 runs, 2 RBI, a walk, and a stolen base. After a slow start, Ellie has been on fire, ranking in the top 5 of runs, homers, and steals, not to mention the fact that his slash line is borderline incredible, with an OPS over 1,000. While the strikeout rate is still hovering at 30%, the walk rate has jumped to 15%, and his average is above 300. He's clearly a star, and let's hope he plays like this for the full season. Moving on to pitchers, thanks to Nick Pollock for the Lively with the Sound of Music article. Starting with Max Fried of Atlanta, going up against Miami, 9 innings with 0 earned runs, 3 hits, no walks, and 6 strikeouts. Fried got a Maddux here, complete game shutout in 92 pitches. Yes, it was against the Marlins, and we talked about it at start last week against the Astros. He also got the Marlins the game before that. Those were the 2 games that he was really good at. But he's locating extremely well. The PLV on the start was 5.34, meaning his pitches were also really good. Not just the Marlins here. Kevin Gausman of the Blue Jays went up against Kansas City in a loss, 6.2 innings with no earned runs, 7 hits, 1 walk, and 2 strikeouts. Even in a quality start, there's something to pick on for Gausman. 2 strikeouts really scares us, especially with only 4 whips on his killer splitter. It gave up 18 balls in play, and even though it was 0 earned runs in the start, he still got the loss because Vlad Jr. had an error in fielding the ball at first, leading to 3 unearned. What's encouraging is that the 4-seamer got 12 called strikes, but he still isn't earning any whips. It might be the best time to buy lower if a manager is freaking out about these results. But Gausman is just so good, you have to expect that these results are going to turn around. Moving on to Wednesday, we have Francisco Lindor of the Mets. He actually had a really good game. 4-for-5 with 2 homers, 2 runs, and 4 RBI. Of course, we're all well aware that Lindor started the season out super ice cold. He went 1-for-31 to start. However, since the Mets gave him a standing ovation at Citi Field, he has kind of started to heat up. In this game alone, Lindor actually raised his OPS from 538 to 652, so small sample sizes for the win. There's no real need to worry about Lindor. He is going to have an excellent season. We just have to be patient. Not everyone comes out of the gate running. Gunnar Henderson of the Orioles went 3-for-3 with a homer, 3 runs, 3 RBIs, and a stolen base. Gunnar is absolutely unconscious right now. He's homered in 5 of his last 9 games, and he ranks in the 100th percentile for average exit velocity and 97th percentile for hard hit rate. Gunnar is following up his AL Rookie of the Year campaign with some improvements that have him looking like a legitimate superstar. He's now slashing 309, 373, 649 with 8 home runs and 5 stolen bases through 24 games. Honestly, just an incredible monster. For pitchers, thanks to Nick Pollock for the Knack Masterpiece SP Roundup article. Not a lot of great pitching performances today, but we are going to start with Kyle Gibson of the St. Louis Cardinals. Got the win against Arizona with 6 innings, 1 run, 5 hits, 2 walks, and 6 strikeouts. This is actually Gibson's third quality start of the season, with, of course, 2 starts that helped balloon his ERA to 4.35. The strikeout numbers aren't horrible, and he can help your team for sure, but it's hard to say that he's a matchup-dependent guy, considering that his worst start was when he gave up 7 runs to the Marlins. If you don't like playing lottery tickets, Gibby is just not your guy. Ronaldo Lopez of Atlanta went up against Miami in a no decision. 7 innings with 1 run, 3 hits, 2 walks, and 6 strikeouts. Rayla's been cooking, despite still sticking with his 4-seam slider 2-pitch mix. The slider has been working wonders with a 25% swinging strike rate on the pitch alone, but it's still debatable whether this starter's experiment is going to work. The last season he had a full starter's workload was 2019. Since then, his highest inning count in a season was 66 innings pitched last season. I know everyone is saying it, but he's a great sell-high candidate, but if you do decide to keep him, he is probably going to be a solid purveyor of wins, even though, of course, in this game against Miami of all teams, he didn't get a win. Moving on to Thursday, thanks to Ryan Lauren for the Edward Knock Life hitter recap article, and we can talk about a twin for another good reason. It's kind of an incredible podcast for me. Edward Julian of Minnesota went 2-for-4 with 2 homers, 2 runs, and 2 RBIs. Eddie Julian had his second 2-homer game of the season. While there were fears that Julian would get platooned every game this season, he still has had 16 plate appearances against lefties, so he is getting opportunities out there. The Twins will still occasionally sit him against lefties, but he is getting into more spots. Funny enough, he's actually performing better against lefties compared to righties, but I think this is really just small sample size issue, and the fact that he actually hasn't been that good this season, but he is kind of turning around the past couple games. Julian's value still mostly comes in OBP leagues, but we'll see if he's developing some power early this season, as he already has 7, I believe, to start. William Contreras of the Brewers, 2-for-4 with a homer, 3 runs, an RBI, a walk, and a stolen base. He is easily the best offensive catcher in baseball right now, 23 runs and 22 RBI total. He's on track to get 30 homers on the season. He's in the 99th percentile for average and OBP. Slugging is just below in the 95th percentile. He's 9th in the league for hard contact rate. There's a lot of things that we could talk about, but we are going to have an interview with pitcherless writer Randy Holt to talk about the Brewers, so I'll save some of that conversation later. That being said, if this continues for Contreras, he might not just be the best catcher in baseball. He might actually be a legitimate top 30, top 20 hitter if this continues for him. Moving on to pitchers, thanks to Nick Pollock for the Sim City article, we are going to talk about Mackenzie Gore of the Nationals. Went up against the Dodgers, got a loss there. 6 innings with 1 run, 7 hits, 2 walks, and 4 strikeouts. Gore located his fastball up in the zone, earning him 11 whiffs, giving him a gallows pole for the night, actually. The slider still wasn't completely there, but at least his curveball earned him a few called strikes. Plus, he was facing the Dodgers, which maybe gives a little hope considering he gets to face the Rangers and the Jays next. Hold on, but maybe not too tightly to Gore. And then Yoshinobu Yamamoto of the Dodgers in the same game, 6 innings, 0 earned runs, 4 hits, 1 walk, and 7 strikeouts in a win. We haven't talked too much about Yamamoto this season, but he is putting together a pretty solid rookie outing. The season ratios aren't that great. He has a 3.54 ERA and a 1.07 whip, which is kind of around league average. But what is great is his 32% strikeout rate and a 5.2% walk rate. He's earning whiffs just as advertised, and other than his disastrous first start against the Padres, he's mostly been good for your fantasy teams. Even in a poor start against the Mets last Friday, he still managed 9 strikeouts in a quality start. Well, that wraps up the player performances for the week. Obviously, a lot of combo meals in this one, a lot of homers and stolen bases, a lot of good performances from young guys. Obviously, it sucks that Jackson Holliday is going down because he just hasn't had some of these performances. But yeah, just some really good outings from guys. And definitely keep checking out the hitter recap and the SP Roundup articles every single day just to keep track of what the heck is going on in baseball. Because yeah, a lot of these performances, frankly, I didn't know too much about. But being able to, you know, go through those articles and understand what's going on a day-to-day basis is so helpful to be aware of, you know, what's going on and being prepared for your fantasy teams. With that, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be joined by Randy Holt of Pitcherless to talk about his article on the Milwaukee Brewers and if their current offensive pace is sustainable. All right, we are back and we are talking with Pitcherless writer Randy Holt about his article on the Milwaukee Brewers and whether their hitting is something that can be sustained through the rest of the season. Randy, how are you doing?
I'm not too bad. How are you?
Doing well, doing well. Before we dive into your article, why don't you just give the listeners kind of a quick introduction? You know, how long have you been writing for Pitcherless, or maybe what baseball teams you root for, or how you got involved in baseball writing?
That's a lot of questions to start with. I got involved with baseball writing, honestly, in high school, and that was a longer time ago than I care to actually admit or acknowledge at this point.
Yep.
But I've been writing for Pitcherless for probably, I think I'm going into my third year with it now.
Nice.
But I've kind of reinvigorated myself. I think I've probably written more already this year than I have the last couple, if we're being honest. But I'm probably also like the least fantasy oriented person on the entire Pitcherless staff. And my friends made the point. I was at a game the other day here in Arizona, and we were talking just about our general like mindsets and approaches to baseball. And they're like, no wonder you're always terrible in our fantasy leagues, because I was talking about defense the whole time.
Oh, and sure.
Like, you do know that the guys on your fantasy team aren't actually defending the other players that you're up against that week, which I did know, but I care more about like narratives and trends and defense more than anything. But writing here, I do the depth charts for Baseball Prospectus, and then I'm a Cubs fan, which is why it's interesting that I wrote a very long-winded piece about the Milwaukee Brewers. But I have a steady rotation of teams. Like, I just want entertaining baseball at the end of the day. So I watched a lot of the Padres. The Royals are now on the list, the Phillies. It was the White Sox before Jason Benetti went. They were in the rotation. So,
To be honest, it's probably okay that you're not watching the White Sox now, because that is just a train wreck of a team. So.
Oh, of course, yeah. And even last year they were too, but at least like you had Benetti. And
true, yes.
You had just that soothing commentary happening, and now you don't even have that, so what do you have?
Right, yeah, exactly. I'm a Twins fan, and we just swept them in a 4-game series, so I got a front row seat to how bad that team truly is. So.
I'm actually wearing a St. Paul Saints hat right now.
Oh, nice. So. That's awesome.
Glad to know that I had linked that up without knowing.
Yeah. That's really random to have, and that's awesome that you have a St. Paul Saints hat.
My cousin lives in Little Canada.
Oh, sure. Okay. Yep.
He lives in it. We went and visited a couple of years ago. We went to Target Field for a game.
Nice. All right, that's awesome. Well, all right, let's dive into your article about the Milwaukee Brewers. You know, I believe they're currently, as of today, second in the National League. But I think, you know, your article starts off with a really good preface that basically early season records, while they're fun to follow, they don't necessarily lead to, you know, postseason success, or even kind of just what your record is on the final day of the season. But it's still interesting to look at and see, you know, how are players doing, you know, what is providing some success for a team. And so I think we want to look at, you know, Milwaukee and kind of understand, is this sustainable, right? I think that'll probably be a word that we use a lot in this interview. Yes. But yeah, how sustainable is the offense for this team? So yeah, as you mentioned, the big thing with the Brewers for the longest time is that pitching has been the big part of their success, right? Corbin Burns, Brandon Woodruff, both those guys are, you know, either no longer on the team or no longer pitching. Freddie Peralta's kind of the ace of the staff nowadays. So it's surprising that offense is kind of the reason that they're finding some success. What are your big picture takeaways from their offense that's this season that we didn't see as part of their team last year?
The big things that I noticed when I was looking through, because I tend to look at a lot of the same things, like obviously strikeout and walk rate, and then I'll look at the approaches and the contact quality and all that. And a lot of things with them were really similar kind of across the board. Like they're striking out at a similar rate. They're walking at a similar rate. Their approaches, like there's slightly less swing on out of zone pitches, but it's not really notable enough to really note it. The big trend changes for them over the last couple of years, or over the last, you know, year, as far as we've gotten into the end of April, they've done much better in the power department. Their ISO's up well over what it was last year. They were 28th in the league in ISO last year, and they're 9th right now. And then just getting on base. Last year, they had a team OBP of 319, and they were 17th in the league, and now they're 3rd. And they're walking, you know, at a top 10 rate, but it's not anything astronomical. They're just kind of hitting their way on base. And that's really where I noticed the, kind of the big number between the two seasons is they had a 292 BABIP last year, and now on balls in play this year, they're going for 321 right now. So that was kind of the big one, despite not really hitting the ball that much harder or having any real reason for having more fortune. But yeah, those are the big things. Just a little more power, a little more on base, and then just really getting a little luckier at the plate at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, those things usually add up to, you know, better offense, I guess, you know, more base runners, and being able to get those base runners in is nice. And we'll talk about probably BABIP a little bit later, but it is one of those things where, like you mentioned, it is somewhat luck based, but you also do find that like sometimes some teams or some players specifically can kind of sustain the higher BABIP numbers instead of regressing to the mean as we expect.
Yeah.
So before we get into some of the players that you decided to take kind of a deeper look into the article, there's two players that I want to talk about in the Brewers that, one of them for sure, offseason addition. The other one, you know, was a guy who wasn't on last year's roster. And so we're, of course, talking about Jackson Trujillo, who is kind of the, you know, the rookie who signed a huge contract last season, now is going to, you know, and started opening day for the Brewers. And then Rhys Hoskins, who was over at the Phillies, obviously broke his leg, ended up coming to Milwaukee on a short-term deal. One of my favorite players. For both these guys, you know, what are they adding to the team, and how have you kind of seen them just help out the team as a whole?
Chirio's not quite there yet. I think early in the year, he flashed like immediately. He was showing off the power, the speed, the glove especially. But he's definitely struggled. He's struggling to not strike out. He's struggling to get on base. He's showing power. Like, he's got 4 homers. His ISO is 163. So, like, when he does put the ball in play, which he has not done a lot of since the middle of April, it's impactful. So, like, he's loud. He's exciting. It's very fun. I think he adds, like, as far as, like, almost an intangible quality where you have this excitement factor that you maybe didn't have with recent Brewers teams, even ones that won division titles.
Sure.
So, you know, we'll see how long it takes him to make those adjustments, because he's struck out over 4 times as much in the last 2 weeks as he has hits. But, I mean, the flashy tools are fun no matter what happens.
Yeah.
Especially if you're an objective observer and you're not a fan of that specific team.
For sure. Yeah, I mean, I think, like, if you without the context that you mentioned, right, where basically the last 2 weeks have been tough for him, you look at his line and it's like, it's you know, it's solid, right? For a rookie who's batting in the 9th hole, it's not bad. 10 runs, 13 RBIs, 4 homers and steals combined, total each. So, yeah, definitely solid numbers. But the number that does stand out, right, that 34% strikeout rate. You kind of expect that from rookies, but, you know, obviously we'd like to see that come down. What about Hoskins? You know, probably for a lot of people, this was, you know, their big free agent signing, and how has he kind of been in the role for the Brewers this season?
I wanted Hoskins to be a Cubs so bad. And I'm not upset about Michael Bush because he's obviously off to
a really strong 100%. Start.
But yeah. I was not devastated that he didn't pick the Cubs, but devastated that he didn't pick the Cubs and he went to the Brewers.
Yeah, yeah.
That aside, he is still very much the same Reese Hoskins that we have come to know. Mm-hmm. He's just gotten very, very unlucky so far. Like, his power's down a little bit, mm-hmm. but his strikeout rate is also down. And he's walking at the same rate, putting balls in play. He's a .233 average on balls in play, though. So just incredibly unlucky, but he looks to be very much the same pre-injury Reese Hoskins from a skill set standpoint, which has to be really encouraging.
Right. And, I mean, his career BABIP, like, if we want to take that into account, is .274. So he's 40 points lower than that where he is currently. So you kind of hope that regresses to the mean, so to speak, but he's still on pace for essentially 30 homers, but kind of replicating the season he had in 2022 with the Phillies. So, yeah, still pretty much kind of the same hitter for the most part, which is right, which absolutely. Is a good thing.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. So time to dive into kind of these other guys who have been just doing real well this season and trying to see, you know, how sustainable are these performances. And the first guy we're going to talk about is William Contreras here. In my opinion, probably the best offensive catcher in baseball right now. I think he's definitely just on a heater, in my opinion. Numbers are really good off the screen. 987 OPS. He has 23 runs and 22 RBI on the season. Of course, we're not saying this is a huge breakout from Contreras. He's been kind of a mid 800s OPS guy for the last couple seasons. Everyone's kind of, you know, thought of him as, you know, a top three, top five catcher for sure in terms of offense. But this jump is a little bit more than maybe we were expecting him to have. What has led to that improvement this season? But also maybe what's one thing to be cautious about in terms of how Contreras is approaching the first month of baseball?
I think the answer to both of those questions is his BABIP. Because, like, I looked all over, because the article I wrote started as, the premise was initially like, all right, William Contreras is mashing.
Yeah.
What is he doing differently? And mm-hmm. the straight answer is, like, not a lot. The only real change I saw was he's being much more aggressive on pitches inside of the strike zone, which is an objectively good thing.
Yep.
To be swinging more. He jumped from 64% swing rate in the zone to 73 so far. So very aggressive on those in zone pitches. He's not hitting the ball that much harder. He's not walking more or seeing a bunch more pitches. He's just hitting the ball in the strike zone and getting very fortunate when he does so, because he's a good hitter.
Yeah, I think just with that BABIP, the worrying thing that you list is his BABIP is .439, but his ground ball rate is almost 60%.
Yes, I did notice both of those things.
Yeah, that's like one of those things where it's like, wow, he must be getting incredibly lucky on all these hits through the infield, because, that's just an insane BABIP. Like, even without that context of the ground ball rate, like, it's insane. But having a .439 BABIP is just, that's kind of nuts.
Yeah, he's been a guy who's had a high mark in that figure for the last 2 years. He went .344 and .348 the last 2 years. So it's not like he doesn't usually have something that's a little abnormal.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, over .430 is, I don't know that's sustainable.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, he is smoking the ball, like you mentioned. It's his hard hit rate is the highest of his career right now at 44%. But yeah, that's definitely one of those numbers that the BABIP at least is definitely one of those numbers that you expect to come down. But it is interesting that it's kind of coming along with more aggressiveness within the strike zone.
Right. Yeah. And when you expect regression, I mean, you expect regression with, mm-hmm. with that level of that figure, but at the same time, like, the things in the approach that have changed, even if it's just something as simple as swinging pitches in the strike zone, like, the regression probably won't be that damaging. It'll just be normal regression to a normal number.
Right. Yeah. And, I think for him, that BABIP coming down, you know, might bring that OPS down more to maybe, you know, high 800s, low 900s, something like that. But that still means that he is a high quality catcher and still probably one of, you know, the top three, top five guys that you want on your team.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, the next guy that we want to talk about is, unfortunately, I just realized in reading your article that he was injured, and that's Christian Yelich, who is currently dealing with back soreness, which seems to always be his thing. So he's currently on the 10-day IL. But I think the struggle obviously is that after his MVP season in 2018 and then his 2019 season, where he really took advantage of that rabbit ball, it just really hasn't been a whole lot of success for Yelich. Last season, like, I think some people were trying to find some silver linings there. He had 106 runs, 28 steals, and an 817 OPS. Didn't reach 20 homers, but I think was at 19. So not like a pretty decent season overall. This year, though, through his, 11 games, which, granted, because he's been on the injured list, we just haven't seen much of Christian Yelich. He at least was swinging a hot bat in those first 11 games. Obviously, it's hard to make some real get some real takeaways about him because he's been on the injury list for the past couple of weeks. But what did you like from Yelich in those first couple games? And is there anything there that you think is something that could be replicated once he gets back?
So the big thing I wrote about Yelich when he first started kind of dipping, when I used to write for Beyond the Box Score, and that was one of my things, is I wrote about Christian Yelich a lot for some reason several years ago. But when he first started to kind of come back down from his best player in the National League type of heights, he was just driving the ball into the ground.
Right.
And that has been his issue, is his inability to elevate. Like, he hit ball on the ground almost 60% of the time each of the last two seasons. So while he did make a lot more hard contact, so I think there was a lot of promise with what he was doing last year because the quality of contact went up, it was still very predominantly on the ground. But this year he had started to elevate far more. He had cut it down to 45, which would be his lowest percentage of ground balls since 2019, which I think was the last time he was, like, good.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was his highest hard hit rate too. He was up over 50% in the hard hit percentage. So, it looked like, obviously 11 games is a very small sample when you're looking at swing trends and zone trends, but yeah. He was heavy on the swings in kind of the upper middle and then on the upper inside parts of the zone. So maybe he was being a little more intentional than he had been the last couple of years and trying to get more elevation by approaching a higher pitch. But you do, like, I'm a year older than Christian Yelich. My back hurts all the time. So I understand that when you look up his injury history, like, that's what's there. It's just back.
Yep.
So you wonder, like, is that impact going to continue to impact his ability to elevate? Because he's hitting the ball well. I lost my train of thought there. That's what it boils down. He just needs to not hit the ball on the ground, and I think he can provide – he's not going to return to 18 or 19 Yelich, but he could still be a very key cog in this Brewers offense that is suddenly very good.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I remember – I mean, about the same time frame that you were talking about in terms of your writing about Yelich, like, just his hard hit metrics were really solid. Like, he was hitting the ball super hard, but like you mentioned, it was pretty much just always going into the ground. And I was just looking up his launch angle stats. And I mean, there's a lot to be said about average launch angle not being like a great thing to always look at. But like, just looking at his past three seasons, 3.5 degrees, 3.6 degrees, 2.8 degrees, like, basically he's hitting the ball. The average launch angle of all his hits is just kind of flat, right? And then 2018, the launch angle, 5 degrees. 2019, 11.3 degrees. This season, 11.7 degrees. So there is at least some clear indication that, like, more of his hits were, being elevated in those seasons where, he was doing really well. And, you couple that with the fact that at least his exit velocities kind of look around the same as what they've been. Maybe there is more of a concerted effort for him to get, below the ball and be able to, elevate it when it comes off his bat. And I guess that's something we'll see when he returns from injury.
Yeah, and looking at his numbers, like, he's not the Christian Yelich we knew from a few years ago, but he gets on base. He'll still, obviously, the last 2 years, he's been much more active on the bases after 20 and 21. So, I mean, he's still going to be a really important player, but man, if he can elevate when he gets back, he'll be he'll be something.
Yeah, it is fun to look at that 11-game sample and see his 744 slugging percentage.
Right.
But, yeah, to maybe expect that when he comes back is maybe a little bit of a
wish casting. I think the 410 ISO is coming down.
Yeah, that might be a number that we see drop in the next couple months. All right, so the next question is really kind of three questions in one, so we'll take this maybe a player at a time. But you call out basically three members of the Brewers infield. We've got Willy Adames, Bryce Terang, and Joey Ortiz. I think most fantasy managers, you know, baseball people are kind of familiar with what Adames can provide. You know, he's been a pretty solid bat for the Brewers the past couple seasons after coming over from Tampa Bay. What have you liked seeing from Adames this season compared to, you know, his previous years?
I think it's just his general approach. Let me get the numbers pulled up here. Like, he's always been a pretty similar player, especially since he arrived in Milwaukee. Like, mm-hmm. you're getting 20, 25 or more home runs. He'll add a couple steals. On the non-fantasy side, he'll play really good defense, but he doesn't spend a particularly large amount of time on base because he hasn't really walked. And last year he got it up a little bit. And then early on this year, it looked like his approach had really improved to the point where he had toned down his swings a little bit and he was taking more pitches, and getting a lot of the same results, but also walking more just in general. So his swing rate's down, his chase rate's down, his swinging strike rate is down. So all those things are really encouraging when you want a guy just to get on base more, because he's obviously a power bat, but he can add those steals as well. So it's come down a little bit since I wrote it. He's kind of trended a little bit back up. And this is the thing that I've definitely wondered about, especially, you know, following the Cubs. I've written about their approach early in the year. You know, they just killed Dodgers starting pitching with high pitch counts because they were just working it every time. And then they went on the road and it all went away. So, like, this is one thing that I'm really interested in continuing to explore this year, especially in relation to a player like Adames. Is a new approach when you're 28 years old, is that something that is going to be kind of like you're going to slip back in your old habits now and then? Are you going to just kind of gradually lose it over the course and exhaustion of a full season? What's that going to look like? Right now it looks good, but he's definitely a player where I kind of want to continue to study that and just monitor how he is approaching each at bat just from a pitch count and a swing rate standpoint.
I mean, I'm not, you know, I've never played baseball at a high level. Like, I'm curious kind of like the mental fatigue of, like, you know, when you're in July or you know, August, and all those, you know, big breaking pitches that you weren't swinging on in April and in May, you know, are you more susceptible to, you know, try to swing at something that's a little bit more outside the zone that you wouldn't have, that you would have had more discipline of in terms of, you know, not swinging earlier in the season. Just curious, yeah, about that mental fatigue. Does that play a role in, you know, having more discipline at the beginning of the season?
Yeah, especially for us on the, you know, observer side, like, how can we even quantify that if we don't know that firsthand from the player? So, yeah, it's an interesting thing because it's not something we don't think about, just like general fatigue necessarily. See a player go on the aisle, sure, they're injured, but you know, fatigue, especially in relation to such a strong mental aspect like approach, is really interesting to think about.
Yeah. All right. Well, the next guy to talk about is Bryce Terang. Came up last season, didn't really impress. You know, he only hit .218. OBP was below 300. WRC plus was basically only 60 across around two-thirds of the season, 450 plate appearances. The bright spot was 26 steals, so very nice to see. In 2024, though, I think what we've seen from him is better on-base percentage, .384. Slugging's pretty nice, too, at 500 there. And BABIP has gone up a little bit. What have you liked from Terang, and you know, what do you see from him in terms of his sustainability?
Of the players I talked about, especially the younger ones, Terang is kind of the one that I was the most excited about in terms of just being able to maintain. because he's not doing anything drastically different. Like, his BABIP jumped up, of course, but he's making more contact. He's making slightly harder contact, but not like unsustainably higher contact. He just feels and looks more comfortable. Mm-hmm. Like, I think he was just overwhelmed. He struck out far more than his skill set and his track record in the minors says he should last year. This year he's putting balls in play. He's showing occasional power. He's obviously using his speed to his advantage quite a bit with, you know, a dozen steals already, which is very encouraging. But I think, like, the simplest explanation is, like, he just needed 448 plate appearances and then got a little more comfortable.
Yeah, I like that in the article you bring up his ideal plate appearance, because it has gone up this season, and you kind of see that through the slightly improved walk rate. But really, it's like some familiarity that allows his batting average has so far jumped up like 100 points, you know, granted over 87 plate appearances, but he is approaching the plate in a better way than he was last season. And I think the stats are showing that.
100%.
Well, we get to talk about a little bit of defense here, I think, because the next guy we're talking about is Jory Ortiz. And the only reason I bring up defense is he's currently playing third base for them. The Brewers don't exactly have a ton of options at third base. Ortiz obviously came over in that trade for Corbin Burns, and I think it was kind of unsure if he was going to, you know, get a start with the big league team immediately. But he's found a spot at third base. You mentioned kind of being a rookie. I'm sure there's a little bit less of maybe a shorter leash on Ortiz. How has he kind of fit into this team as kind of the new guy, and you know, being able to produce from the, you know, the number eight hole in the lineup, but you know, being a guy who, you know, was slotted in, came over in a trade, and is now kind of doing okay for himself as a bat.
Hey, he's hanging on. He's the one that I'm most unsure of, mm-hmm. for a couple reasons. One is his walk rate is very high, and you know, nothing about him really says that he's a high walk guy. He's a guy who makes a ton of contact and he hits his way on base. But he's walking at 14% clip right now, which is crazy for him.
Yeah.
Based on everything we've seen. So, like, he's working his way on base. He doesn't steal. He doesn't really hit for power. So what I wonder for him, especially over the course of the rest of this year, is, like, as the Milwaukee outfield especially gets healthy, because we've mm-hmm. heard all about, like, the Sal Frelick, you know, he's going to play third base thing earlier in the spring.
Yeah.
You know, does he get pushed out just because, you know, if you're choosing between Frelick or Terang, like, they offer a little bit more upside, even though Ortiz can hit. He's a contact oriented hitter, which is valuable at any part of your lineup, mm-hmm. but he doesn't offer as much in terms of those really impact areas like power or speed in the way that the other guys do. So right now he's fine. He's working his way on base in a variety of ways. I just wonder if he, in the remainder of this season at least, what his role is going to look like as the team eventually gets healthier.
Yeah, and I mean, you don't talk about this in the article, but does his defense at third base make him a little bit more of a risky play there compared to some of the other guys you talked about, or even Oliver Dunn, who's currently kind of the bench infielder for that team?
I'm honestly not sure. His numbers on defense are fine, but mm-hmm. I guess the flip side of my argument that there's not a lot of, or there are other options from a lineup standpoint, there's also not a ton of other options from a defense standpoint, because Oliver Dunn has not been terrific at the plate mm-hmm. in what does he have, like, almost 60 plate appearances. And then, you know, you have Owen Miller around and that's kind of it. So unless they did move Frelick back into the infield, I guess I might've just undermined my own argument by saying, who else are you putting at third base?
Yeah. Well, maybe there is no one. So,
right. So,
okay. Well, I mean, good to know that these three guys, at least, you know, in the Brewers infield, you know, that there's reason to believe that some of this stuff is real. I think for Ortiz, like you mentioned, that walk rate is pretty solid. But is it something that he's going to be able to keep throughout the year? And I mean, you have to remember, like, this is also his first season in the majors too. So, unlike Terang, who had 450 plate appearances last season, this is Ortiz's opportunity to kind of build up those plate appearances now and get that experience, as a major leaguer. Especially as a guy who, is more of a contact guy. So, you know, being able to, you know, see major league pitching and get a feel for how to attack it, you know, this is kind of his opportunity to experience that.
Right. And he's kind of indicative of what my broader premise ended up being in that article too, was like the Brewers are taking a lot of pitches. Like they mm-hmm. walk a lot. They see an above average amount of pitches per plate appearance, but they're also not super making a lot more contact overall or a lot more hard contact. So that's where I get a little worried about some of these guys, is like, it's not necessarily showing like a correlation between the two things. It's like, we're taking a lot of pitches, we're getting on base, and then we occasionally mm-hmm. hit for power. Which is very fortunate when you're in a small April sample, but as the season wears on, like, is that lack of a process going to hurt them at all and kind of lead to some of the regression that we might see from some of these guys?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that kind of covers the majority of your article. Definitely recommend people to check this out. There's a lot of stuff that we didn't talk about that was covered, that Randy covered in the article. So definitely check it out on Pitcher List. Before we let you go, Randy, you know, any upcoming articles that you are writing or any ways that people can follow you on social media?
I am on Twitter at Randall Pink Floyd without the I in pink, just PNK. My Going Deep columns on Pitcher List publish every Wednesday, and then I do the Saturday morning news column as well. So those are the two spots on Pitcher List. I'm also in Northside Baseball writing about the Cubs.
Nice. Any ideas for what your next Going Deep article is going to be about?
I'm planning to look at the Diamondbacks and their kind of lack of an identity compared to last year. I have so many ideas swirling. I want to look at Jake Cronenworth because he's one of my guys. I love lefty swings.
Okay.
And he looks like he's starting to kind of come out of his 2-year funk. So I think those are kind of the immediate angle. And then I might look at William Contreras' brother down in St. Louis too, because his defense is looking really good. But it might not matter because they're pitching so bad.
That's true. Yeah.
So I mean,
We love Lance Lynn we have a love hate relationship with Lance Lynn on this podcast, and it's always exciting to see him do well, and then other times he'll just have like a, you know, 7-inning game where he shuts down the Dodgers but only gets one strikeout and you're wondering what the heck is going on. So
right.
All right, well, thanks again, Randy, for coming on the show, and yeah, definitely people check out his weekly column that's coming up on Pitcher List on Wednesdays.
Appreciate you.
All right. Thanks again to Randy for coming on the show. Appreciate the conversation about the Milwaukee Brewers. We are going to move into streamers. We are going to start with Simeons Woods Richardson, who had a good start on Thursday against the White Sox. He is 14% rostered in Yahoo, 6% rostered on ESPN. And Tuesday, he gets the White Sox again. I know this feels like a homer pick, and honestly, it kind of is. But SDBR just provided a good start against the White Sox last Thursday, and he gets them again this week. The White Sox are the worst team in baseball, and Woods Richardson has seen some life this season. He has increased velocity, and he's throwing a lot of strikes. This really is a pickup and drop, but for some early week success, Woods Richardson should provide you with some quality innings. Next, we're going to talk about Rodery Munoz, who is just basically not rostered on Yahoo or ESPN. On Tuesday, he is supposedly coming up against Colorado. He was featured in Nick's SP write-up last Saturday, so check that out for a deeper dive into his pitching performance. That being said, the only reason I'm actually highlighting this is because it might not actually be Munoz starting. This is just according to Roster Resource. He's listed as the probable starter because Jesus Luzardo just got placed on the IL. But this also might end up being Max Meyer, who's 24% roster in Yahoo, 7% on ESPN. In my opinion, he should have never been sent on the AAA, but if you're looking for another early week stream, I think this could be a good opportunity against Rocky Road, depending on who it is. If it's Munoz, a little bit more caution. If it's Meyer, I would pick that up. And finally, Bailey Falter, 5% roster in Yahoo, 3% on ESPN. Falter has had a decent string of starts after a rough first outing, but he just went 7 innings with 1 run and 8 strikeouts against the Milwaukee offense we just talked about. He's slated to start against Oakland on Monday, and then he gets Colorado in Pittsburgh on Sunday. So Falter should be a great 2-start stream if you're willing to try that. Otherwise, pick him up for either start, and you should get something decent out of it. And then finally, with batters, we're going to talk about Mike Tauchman, who was 5% rostered on Yahoo, 1% on ESPN. He's on the major league roster due to injuries, but he's made the most of it with 13 runs and 17 RBI. The Cubs recently moved him up to second in the order, so he'll continue to get more opportunities, and they clearly like what his bat is doing. If you're looking for help in an OBP league, Tauchman might be a great choice, and he currently has a 437 OBP, mainly due to his 20% walk rate. And that's it for streamers, both for pitchers and batters. A lot of interesting options there. Obviously check out the SP Streamers article that Nick has every single day to see who you should be picking up. But this is kind of a good first look at the week and who you should be lining up to pick up in your leagues. Well, that wraps it up for this week. If you're looking for updates on the show, you can find us on Twitter at ThisWeekPL. You could send us your comments and questions at ThisWeekPLpod@gmail.com. You can also use the Discord. We have a podcast mailbag channel there if you'd like to ask any questions. You can find myself on Twitter at TheJohnKa. You can find Lee at Regicidal. If you haven't done so already, you can subscribe to the Pitcherless podcast feed, or this feed as well, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you listen to your podcast, and leave us a 5-star review if you enjoy the show. Lastly, sign up for Pitcherless Plus or Pitcherless Pro. By doing so, you can join us on the Pitcherless Discord and get advice from all of the fantasy experts and writers over there. That's all for this week. We'll be back next week with another episode of This Week in Fantasy Baseball. For Lee, I'm John, and we'll see you in the next one. Later, everyone.